A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on October 12, 1997, in the series Meeting God Again for the First Time, entitled The God We Never Knew. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 1, verses 1 through 5, Psalm 139, and Acts 17, verses 16 through 31. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Consciously or unconsciously, I suppose we are all here this morning because we long for some fresh experience of the living God down in the depths of our being. Becoming conscious of it now and again is that deep yearning, that hunger, that thirst. Would we not long to meet God again for the first time? I'm sure that that's what we want at the core of our being. That's what we want for our children, the ones we bring to the baptismal font. Is what we want for our grandchildren. Indeed, a sense of grace afresh. And sometimes the best way to determine where we are is to look back over the way that we've come. And we realize that our longing and even the somewhat diseased state of society in our time is really nothing new in the historical movement in history. 200 years ago, Friedrich Schleiermacher, a German preacher, theologian, wrote a little bundle of essays which was entitled On Religion, Speeches Addressed to Its Cultural Despisers. Isn't that interesting? On Religion, Speeches Addressed to Its Cultural Despisers. Friedrich Schleiermacher was born in a line of preachers. His grandfather had been a red-hot evangelistic type. Perhaps in some reaction to that, his father was a rather cool, rational preacher. But he believed that the institutional church religion was necessary for the moral education of the lower classes, and so he sort of played along with it. He was a churchman, so to speak. But he had preached, according to his own acknowledgement, for a period of 12 years without any faith, which is not so unusual. Yet he wanted something different for his two children, and so he sent Friedrich and Charlotte to the Moravian Fellowship that was a very warm Christian group in Germany. And for 4 years during his impressionable adolescence, Friedrich Schleiermacher imbibed the Moravian piety and devotion. It stamped him for the rest of his life, but it was a time in Germany when German culture was blossoming to its fullness. I don't suppose you care about any of the German philosophers of the time, but it fascinates me, so put up with it. At the time that Schleiermacher was a student, Georg Friedrich Hegel was a student, Schelling was a student, Schlegel was a student. These names are like the pantheon of the gods of the German philosophical movement that blossomed into the high culture of Germany during the 19th century. And so Friedrich Schleiermacher was stamped with Moravian piety, but he had a deep hunger as well, a fascination with this burgeoning cultural movement. And he had been destined to become a preacher, and he sought ordination and gained ordination, and eventually ended up in Berlin, quite a figure in the German Reformed Church. But he also was very well connected with all the fine cultural salons of the day. And thus, he wrote this bundle of essays, I'm sure, to those with whom he associated, who gave evidence of outgrowing religion, on religion, speeches addressed to its cultural despisers. Friedrich Schleiermacher went on to write Adogmatics, the Christian faith, and is thought of as the father of modern theology as the 19th century dawned. And at the heart of that theology was his conviction that at the heart of religion is a feeling of absolute dependence. I suppose that in all of the burgeoning culture and exploding knowledge, Schleiermacher was seeking to find that place where authentic religion could be rooted. That feeling then of absolute dependence, that life, after all, is not something that we have created, that it is a gift, that we do not hold our destinies in our hands, that there is that which embraces us and upholds us, that feeling of absolute dependence was Schleiermacher's manner of understanding his own devotion, his own religious experience. It was important for him to be thinking about the root of religion in that 19th century. For Feuerbach, born in 1804 or 06, who said that religion is nothing but the human creation, the feeling of dependence. There is no counterpart. It is simply all projection from the human person. And Karl Marx, 1844, and Nietzsche, about the same time, and Sigmund Freud, 1856, the giants of the development of the modern atheistic movement, that movement that rejected God out there, the theism that was part and parcel of the Christian tradition. Schleiermacher was trying in such an environment to find a place to stand, a place for the soul to rest. A person who had experience of God and was trying to make sense of it and give witness to it in credible fashion. Well, toward the end of the 18th century, not only was there that development of modern atheism, but there was also that breaking forth of scientific knowledge. It was in the early 20th century that Einstein began his research into relativity, 1916, the general theory of relativity, which transformed the landscape of the cosmos. And it was in that period of time that this nation was experiencing great social unrest, the industrialization, the urbanization, the movement to the cities, massive immigration that changed the face of American society, economic development, social unrest, and It was a day of heavy revivalism in this country. When the revivalists, reflecting a very conservative evangelical theology, were trying to say, make the world go away. Take it off my shoulders. Say the things you used to say and make the world go away. And into the pulpit of the First Presbyterian Church of New York City on a May Day, Sunday in 1922, Harry Emerson Fosdick went into the pulpit. I'm reminded of that sort of Schleiermacher's experience. The one triggers the other with me. Fosdick pleading with that fundamentalist mentality that had rejected the explosion of knowledge in the modern world. Fosdick saying, give us room, those of us who value the ancient faith but need to bring it into relationship with the knowledge that is a part of our world. Those of us who cannot live in a schizophrenic compartmentalization that has faith over here and knowledge over here, just give us space. You don't have to change anything you believe. Wherever you find comfort, whatever works is fine. And that old system has borne wonderful fruit, but give us room, those of us who need the space to think of our faith in light of knowledge and knowledge in light of our faith. 1922. For a period of about 14 years, the Presbyterian Church was rocked with that fundamentalist controversy. And yet the world continued on its way. The ramifications of that atheistic thought, that naturalism that laced the 19th century was being felt. The landscape of the cosmos was transformed with increasing insight into astrophysics, subatomic particles, and all of the massive developments in the human sciences, the understanding of the human person, of human society. All of that going side by side. In 1962, a bishop in the Church of England, John A.T. Robinson, published a little book, Honest to God. And Robinson was a bishop of the church and spoke about his own equivocation. He said, I feel a line goes right through the middle of my being. Because I am a churchman, I am deeply embedded in the faith. I have that old framework which works for me, but I also know increasingly that framework is being challenged by everything else that I'm learning from all other avenues of inquiry. And so he said, there are those who are trying to translate the ancient faith into new and modern language, which is always important, but he said, I feel that there is a much more radical transformation that is going to be necessary, more than simply recasting the traditional orthodoxy in modern terms, a much more radical recasting, I would judge, is demanded, in the process of which the most fundamental categories of our theology, of God, of the supernatural, and of religion itself, must go into the melting. He pleaded just as Fosdick pleaded, simply for space to do this. He pleaded to be viewed not as one who was destructive of faith, but as one who was indeed a defender of the faith. So deeply did he believe, but so critically did he survey the contemporary situation. But he was not optimistic about how this little tract for the times would be received. For he wrote, I am inclined to think that the gulf must grow wider before it is bridged, and that there will be an increasing alienation both within the ranks of the church and outside it, between those whose basic recipe is a mixture as before, however revitalized, and those who feel compelled above all to be honest wherever it may lead them. 1962, it created a flurry of activity. He was called to resign. Books were published about the debate. And that was nearly half a century ago, when in 1996, Marcus Borg writes The God We Never Knew. Marcus Borg is a member of the Jesus Seminar. He's a Jesus scholar, not a God scholar, as he says. We took the theme of these fall Sundays from his earlier work, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. And today's sermon subject is the title of the book, The God We Never Knew. Very much on the lines of J.A.T. Robinson, Marcus Borg speaks in very personal terms of his own spiritual pilgrimage. Growing up a devout Lutheran in the Midwest, as a child imaging God as Pastor Thorson, God who was a finger-shaking God, consequently. All of the popular Christian conceptuality that has been a part of most of our lives. And then, in the period of his education, his advanced education, being no longer able to believe that old system and that old view of God out there, and going through a period of atheism until he came later to a fresh spiritual experience, until he had a new taste of the living God. Not all scholars who write about religion reveal who they are, but Marcus Borg does, and I appreciate the fact that he comes through as a man of deep faith and genuine piety, but a man whose faith and piety has been purged by the fires of modernity, and who in this little volume, The God We Never Knew, documents his own faith journey, in which he has moved from a God out there to a God who is in here, and more, to a God who is eminent in the creative process and the ground of all existence, the God who gives creativity and meaning and direction to the whole story of creation. He documents in his own experience how God up there was no problem. And we all know that that's true too, because we make such a quick translation, we don't even think about it anymore. We know God's not up there. The biblical cosmology was heaven above and hell beneath, and we caught in between. But we don't even think twice when we celebrate Ascension Day and say that Jesus ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of God. I don't have to qualify that and say to you, well, you know that doesn't mean up. Because we immediately translate that. We've lived with that biblical terminology so long that its metaphoric nature is obvious to us. And then when we began to learn about space and the old three-decker universe of the biblical cosmology was surpassed, transcended, replaced, with spatial terminology. We began to speak of God out there. But as Borg and as Robinson points out, that was not such a difficult translation. That didn't take so much. Obviously, if God is not up there because the universe is of this sort of expanding spatial thing, then God beyond would be an obvious translation. But it's still a spatial metaphor. But the next translation is not as simple. Because in the old popular conception of things, the things that we learned in church school, in catechism, the conceptuality that manifests itself in our prayers and in our hymns and in our liturgies, all of our common fare, all of our religious language, posits a supernatural super being beyond creation, who looks down upon it, who occasionally intervenes in it, and who is alongside of the whole created order. I can imagine some of you now saying, well, isn't that the way it is? Never thought about anything else. Well, let me suggest you don't have to. Don't even bother your head about it. But if you have thought about it, then know that there are those who are saying that that conception of a supernatural being beyond, outside, who needs to come in, which is the biblical conception, after all, Jesus is the second person of the Trinity, who is the divine intruder who descends and ascends. If that still works, that's just fine. But know that there is, even in the Christian tradition, more than that that is stated. The old theology spoke about transcendence and the immanence, the outside and the withinness of God. Although for all practical purposes, it was a supernatural kind of super being out there who did come in to be with. Immanence was given a place, but a minor place in our popular conception of God. Borg and Robinson were deeply indebted to the theologian Paul Tillich, who thought of God in terms of the ground of being. Not another being in the line of beings, but the ground of being, the creative source of all, and that which gives meaning and direction to the whole process. Modern atheism was a rejection of theism, that supernatural being out there. But panentheism is an attempt to say that God is not outside, but the transcendent one in the midst, giving life to everything, present to all things, literally with us, and more. The mystery of reality the holy, the sacred, that breaks through upon us in special moments. The one who creates all in grace and sustains all in mercy and is present to all at all times and all places. I won't say a lot more about that because only a fool would even try to preach about it. But such a fool am I. But what Bishop Robinson, Marcus Borg are groping for is not so unheard of. Paul came to Athens and he saw at this supreme place of human learning and inquiry all of the idols that were representative of the gods and goddesses that inhabited the Greek pantheon. And Paul was disturbed in his spirit because he wanted to give witness to the Eternal One who is the Creator of all things, whom he had come to know in a radically new way through his encounter with Jesus Christ. And so this deeply embedded Jewish believer transformed and turned upside down by an encounter with Jesus goes boldly to the very heart of human culture and learning to proclaim that God is Creator, relating what he's trying to say to those Greek philosophers and poets of which all of his audience were familiar. One of them said, "The God in whom we live and move and have our being." He said, "You see, what I'm trying to say to you is already in your tradition. There have been those who have sensed the immediacy of God." And another who said, "We are God's offspring." And I suppose, finally, the psalmist was giving expression to that fresh experience of God of which I spoke at the beginning. That longing within our hearts to meet God again for the first time. In the beginning, he is quite swept away. He is overwhelmed. He is afraid. For he has a sense that his life is not his own. His life is embraced, enclosed in the abyss that is God. Somehow or other, that his life is not a secret, but rather transparent. And that his privacy is in reality quite public. That he is exposed as none of us would be exposed to this Holy One, the God of Israel. "Where can I flee from your presence? How can I hide? Where can I find a dark corner in order simply to be myself?" But then, that Holy One of Israel is not only for him one who knows all and is everywhere present, but also one who is a gracious presence. And so, in the raging of his own life, he comes finally to that place of resolution where he says, "Search me, O God. Try my ways. See if there be any dark secret place in me, and lead me in the way everlasting by your grace. I guess down deep, that's what all of us are seeking, to be able from the depths of our being authentically with integrity to say, O God, we love you.